This is the first day of this September 2015 two-day Sesshin. And I'm going to be reading from two sources. One is called a book called Happiness Beyond Thought, a critical guide to awakening by a man named Gary Weber. And the other is called The Neuroscience of Mindfulness, Default Mode Network, Meditation, and Mindfulness. And that's by a man named Matthew Williams, who is presumably a neuroscientist. In this talk, what I'd like to do is convey to you, and really myself, simply the need to work hard without strain, without grasping, without a subliminal or conscious demand for results, and without a timetable. What I believe we need to do to make this practice successful is to take a long view, a lifelong effort, give it a lifelong effort, and yet find a way to work hard. And I think the basis for really working hard is to recognize that we all have, at rock bottom, I believe, the longing for the liberation of all beings, not just ourselves. And I see this as our fundamental compassion. It's the basis, obviously, of the four vows that we recite daily. And if we can somehow find a way to make this the basis of our practice, I think we will position ourselves for a life of true giving, a life dedicated to the liberation of all beings. So, I'm going to start with some things which I hopefully will be inspiring. When you meditate, you do it continuously, like the flowing of a stream of water. Meditation should not be limited to a set time following a prescribed procedure and then put away for later. Continuous meditation will lead finally to absorption in the process. The flow of a stream of water captures the concept of uninterrupted, unceasing desire to reach the goal. A stream is not dissuaded in its drive to reach the ocean, continuing beyond, on past rocks, rapids, pools, falls, and even dams. It has an unstoppable desire to reach the ocean. When it reaches its goal, it then dissolves completely, unrecognizable and inseparable. With your meditation, the stream of thoughts, which you call I, is finally absorbed totally in the self. That's capital S self, the ocean of bliss. There's an emerging scientifically validated view on the necessity of practice that is gaining significant credibility. The traditional belief of neuroscience was that the brain was born with all the neurons it was ever going to have, and that experience or training did not change their functional pattern. However, neurophysiologic research on brain functioning is currently being done in legitimate scientific laboratories by top-ranked scientists with the latest tools. These experiments demonstrate the existence of what has been called neuroplasticity, or the ability of the brain to change its functional operation pattern with practice or experience. In this work, experienced meditators have a very different mode of processing sensory inputs and generating and controlling mental states than untrained, inexperienced people. But it's also been demonstrated that these untrained, inexperienced people can be trained in a relatively short time to show a change in their functional neural pattern as well. So what it comes down to is that we are not locked into our past. There is the possibility through this practice to change everything. With training, change will occur no matter what your past, and what you want to do is build concentration and detachment. Most of us understand now, if we're attending sesshins, what concentration is. You keep dropping thoughts in favor of the practice again and again. Detachment, of course, means not to be attached to results. It's extremely important. But there's another kind of a detachment that might be just as important. And I want to just describe what this is. Suppose there's someone you kind of don't like. There's been a negative experience. And normally you see this person and these negative, not strongly negative, but negative thoughts are arising. But then something in you decides that you're not going to listen to these thoughts. That you're not going to let these thoughts determine your behavior. And so you mindfully walk up to where the person is. By mindfully, I mean you pay attention to your walking. You're not in a discriminative mindset anymore then. And you just go there and see what happens. And what you'll find is you've dropped, for the time being, this negativity. And very often a conversation will ensue. And you'll find that it's all washed away, the negativity. And it happens if you can detach yourself, not believe in and not follow negative thoughts. Now I'd like to skip over to the information we have on the default mode network, because this does inspire us to really believe that big change is possible. An article is written in kind of a conversational tone, and I'll just follow the way it was written. To begin our story, we must travel back to 1924 when a German neurologist named Dr. Hans Berger invented the encephalograph, better known by its acronym EEG. Some historians suggest that Dr. Berger went on to join the Nazi SS, while others claimed he was forced into retirement in 1941 because he would not comply with the SS and their medical research techniques. Regardless of which scenario represented the truth, very soon after his retirement, he committed suicide at the age of 68, following a lifelong battle with major depression. After After a few years of working with his invention, Dr. Berger made an observation in a 1929 paper that would be the first step on a long road of discovery. Until then, conventional scientific wisdom held that the brain was only electrically active when a person executed an attention-demanding physical or mental task, like reading, classifying pictures, opening and closing one's hands. However, Dr. Berger's work with his EEG demonstrated that the human brain remains electrically active even at rest, while attention wanders, that is, daydreaming between activities, remembering past events, ruminating. Despite the evidence, Dr. Berger's colleagues largely ignored his claims and continued to focus on brain function during attention-demanding behavior. This trend of exclusively studying the brain during attention-demanding behavior continued for decades. However, all this changed in the year 2001 when a neurologist by the name of Dr. Marcus Reichel at Washington University revealed a network of brain structures responsible for the inattentive wandering of our minds. Furthermore, Dr. Reichel showed that these same structures were deactivated when we engage in attention-demanding tasks. He coined the term default mode network to describe the structures active during our default inattentive state. The following decade revealed many more details about the default mode network that further validated Dr. Berger's almost century-old claim that the brain was still very much on, even when we let our attention wander. So what exactly do I mean when I refer to the mental state of intention, of inattention, that is synonymous with the default mode network? By inattention, I mean times when you're not attending to physical activity, engaged with the external environment, or carrying on a conversation. Inattention, in the way I'm using it, describes states of daydreaming, contemplating the future, reliving the past, or general rumination. The default mode network is the set of neurological structures responsible for this ruminative mental activity. And from now on, I'm going to call it the DMN. And hold on, he says. Right away, these descriptions bring to mind the most common culprits of mental unrest, namely anxiety over potential pasts, presents, or futures, depression, overregulated pasts, presents, or futures, or obsessionality. He says, right you are. Multiple studies have demonstrated that increased connection and activity in parts of the DMN are correlated with major depression and other mental illnesses. And also, I'm going to throw in here, this is correlated with the I, me, mine mindset. I, me, mine lives somewhere there in the default mode network. So if the DMN is a network that is so intimately related to anxiety, depression, and obsessionality, why on earth would evolution have selected for it? The answer is that, like most things in life, a well-balanced DMN helps us plan tasks, review past actions to improve future behavior, and remember pertinent life details. But with the expansion of the brain's intellectual capabilities came the unfortunate drawback that some of these functions could go too far and cause mental anguish. Like most stories, the story of the DMN and the brain has both a protagonist and an antagonist. Perhaps it's slightly punitive to label the DMN as our antagonist, but for the purposes of our discussion, the DMN must suffer this injustice. The protagonist of our story is a series of structures in the brain called the Task Positive Network, TPN, Task Positive Network. The TPN is active during the attention-demanding tasks that we discussed in our introduction. Recalling that the TPN was a network of most interest for the better part of the last century. The TPN is responsible for directing our conscious attention toward the external environment through our five senses, towards our internal bodily states, and to the willful execution of physical and mental action. when we are engaged in conversation, feel the beat of our heart, or experience the breeze on our face, we can thank our TPN for the attentional focus that brings these experiences into conscious awareness. Whoa, he says. It's a strange writing here. These descriptions sound a whole lot like mindfulness practices. Indeed, the TPN is responsible for the attention required to observe one's breath during sitting meditation, attend to our environment during walking meditation, and participate in the social world on a daily basis. Now that we've discussed the major functions of the DMN and TPN, we come to a critical point regarding their relationship. They are mutually exclusive. The activation of the DMN inhibits the TPN and vice versa. In fact, no study has demonstrated the simultaneous activation of the two networks. The relationship between the DMN and the TPN is analogous to the relationship between inhalation and exhalation. Despite their intimate nature, the two cannot exist simultaneously. Now, there's a lot of stuff that might be fun to read here, but it's very complex and we don't need to read it. What I want to say here is that this reminded me of a philosopher I had read during college, Baruch Spinoza, 1500-something, late 1500s, in Holland, in the Netherlands. And his main point in his philosophy was this. He said, "The good is the active soul." Now, we don't use the word soul in Zen, but translate that if you need to. The good is the active mind, the task-positive network. And that's what we use when we meditate. We are turning away from the default mode network, and we're using the active soul, the task-positive network. What comes to mind for me is sometimes when we're chanting the four vows, and it starts to sound to Roshi like this kind of a dirge, like everybody's failing to pay attention to what they're doing. He'll kind of speed it up just a little, make it more lively. What he's done is shift it from an activity of the default mode network into an activity of the task-positive network. And this is what we want to light up in our brain during meditation, again and again and again. It's because the two are mutually exclusive, but obviously one can go between these two very easily. And so later in the article he says, perhaps you're practicing Anapanasati, meaning breath practice, breath mindfulness, a traditional breath-following meditation technique. Your attentional focus, he goes into stuff, I'll just read a little for fun. Your attentional focus, courtesy of the ACC/attender and the IPFC director, is then directed to the insula internal sensor. And it goes on in that way with the technicalities of what goes on in the brain. Anapanasati and open awareness meditation utilize the activation of the TPN network to alleviate the mental suffering generated by the DMN. An overactive DMN is highly correlated with negative mood states and certain mental illnesses. It can simplistically be conceptualized as a ruminative network. It directs our awareness to the past and future while largely ignoring the present. And while the DMN can be used responsibly to plan and organize, we must always be wary of its runaway force. The TPN, the Task Positive Network, is involved in present moment awareness. It's engaged when we attend to the here and now. It is the action network. The TPN is our direct line to mindfulness and the present moment in which worry and sadness cannot survive. And the TPN and the DPN are mutually exclusive. By activating the TPN, we deactivate the DMN. This may be the most powerful lesson of our entire discussion. The next time you feel helplessly lost in worry or self-recrimination, remind yourself of the power of the TPN. Go for a walk, practice yoga, sense your breath, or engage fully in a conversation with a friend. You need not overpower your DMN to escape negative thoughts. You only need to intentionally engage your TPN and allow your natural physiology to disengage your DMN. So what this all amounts to is that there's scientific understanding of what goes on when we're meditating, and how it works with respect to negativity and anxiety and all those things. Now I want to switch back to our main reading. This is about going back to about the studies that have been done about what happens and what it takes to change things in the mind. Gary Weber says, in these studies, musical training has been used as a model for what happens with neuroplasticity. MRI studies on violinists have shown that the brain regions that control finger movements grow in size, longer and more intensive practice produces bigger changes. How much training is required to generate meaningful changes in the brain leading to extraordinary capabilities in playing the violin? What about chess, Olympic sports, sculpting? Well, there will always be savants or Mozarts. For the vast majority of us, it is necessary to do lengthy and intensive practice. It was found that those at the top of their fields in many disciplines had significantly different associated muscle fibers, brain functional patterns, and cognitive abilities. For violinists, those at the top level had practiced for about 10,000 hours. Those at the next lower level, about 7,500 hours. The most extraordinary meditator in the most detailed neurophysiological study had meditated for over 10,000 hours. How long is that? Well, if we're on staff and we sit only just 3 hours a day, 1,000 hours is about a year. If we just sit an hour a day, 1,000 hours is 3 years, more or less, and 10,000 hours would be 30 years. This produces this change in the brain, but Gary points out that decades before there were any sophisticated tools to demonstrate just a controversial and unexpected possibility, Jiddu Krishnamurti, a guy that lived in California last generation, often claimed that there was an organic change in the structure of the brain that accompanied enlightenment. As a personal anecdote, this is from Gary, my journey started with a totally unexpected and unprecedented for me dramatic spiritual experience with no preparation or practice. However, because there had been no preparation or practice, I just couldn't hold it. I was clueless. Despite much subsequent practice of yoga and meditation and other experiences, the page didn't turn until someplace in the 9,000 hours category for each. That is 9,000 hours of yoga and 9,000 hours of meditation. An approximation, he says, as I wasn't using a stopwatch. Perhaps I'm a slow learner of spiritual stuff, which is a distinct possibility. Perhaps my intellectual nature, training, and professional life slowed things. Perhaps my practices were not additive, that is, one and one meant equal to one and a half. Perhaps my attachments were so heavily rooted that it took that long to let go. This is all mental speculation of no consequence. It was just as it was. It will be different for you. If this research is correct, it might explain why very few can perform any number of tasks at a transcendent level, master level, without extensive practice, without extensive reshaping of the neural patterns and functioning in the brain. The mechanics are not sufficiently patterned that transcendent activity and performance can emerge. Indeed, there are few skills that do not require functional mastery before reaching the level at which the activity can become so automatic that something extraordinary or transcendent can occur. In something as prosaic as riding a bicycle, we start with a tricycle, graduated to a two-wheeler with training wheels before removing the training wheels, riding with one hand and then no hands. Why would enlightenment be a chance occurrence made no more likely through some preparation? Virtually all self-realized folks, that is, people of real deep enlightenment, who proclaim that there's nothing that can't be done in preparation for enlightenment, but who give adequate biographies, went through years of spiritual disciplines before the apparently serendipitous triggering event occurred. Isn't it likely that there is a process that does modify the brain in a way that increases concentration and detachment and creates a different functional pattern? Notice this detachment. We talk about concentration a lot. We haven't in the past mentioned much about the need for detachment, except, well, it is mentioned, not to strive, not to, in a self-centered way. Anyway. Further support for the necessity of practice is offered by students who, with little practice or training, have apparent enlightenment experiences. Unfortunately, their experience soon fades, as there was no preparation of the neurological structure, nor understanding of or context within which to support the experience. The field had not been tilled, so the sprout was ultimately overwhelmed by weeds. Ramana Maharshi, who, by the way, is this man's final teacher, Ramana Maharshi was long gone, but it's a very interesting story. He returned to reading, and Ramana Maharshi so inspired him that was a critical person in his saga. Anyway, Ramana Maharshi, probably the most widely recognized enlightened sage of the 20th century, awakened at the age of 16 with little prior spiritual training or inclination beyond casual exposure to some Hindu texts and temples and education in a Methodist school. Ramana achieved his awakening through inquiring into what his own death would be like. Interestingly, even among those who have enlightenment experiences with little apparent prior preparation, there is further support for the necessity of practice. The common observation by these enlightened folk who are open about their own process is that there is a settling period of several years after enlightenment before realization is stable and clear. Perhaps this settling in period continues until a functional neural network repatterning process is completed. Although Ramana had little preparation to his awakening, he spent many years after the experience meditating and remaining silent, apparently grounding and stabilizing the realization. Ramana Maharshi described this as, he says, a jnana, which is a transcendent wisdom, once revealed, takes time to steady itself. The self, that is capital S, remains veiled by vasanas, latent impressions or tendencies, and reveals itself only in their absence. To remain stabilized in it, further efforts are necessary. You know, I'm skipping around here. A critical and unique aspect of this approach is that meditative inquiry is not confined to the time you have available to spend sitting still in a meditative posture. The process can continue 16 or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in whatever you are doing. As you extend the meditation from the defined period of a sitting practice into your daily life, select the daily periodic activity to trigger you to re-engage with the questioning. This reminder, whether it is answering the phone, beginning eating, going to the bathroom, traveling to work, having a cup of tea, every odd-numbered hour, etc., will move you back into the depths and immediacy of your inquiry. It is particularly powerful if you use the inquiry as the first thing on waking to establish the tone for the day and the last thing before falling asleep to place it into consciousness so that it will continue during the night. With inquiry of this intensity, before long, things will begin to change in your life, some subtle, some not so subtle. There is the misconception that nothing happens until the Big Bang of enlightenment. Nothing could be further from the truth. I'm going to read that sentence again. There is the misconception that nothing happens until the Big Bang of enlightenment. Nothing could be further from the truth. Your heart will be lightened before and whether or not an enlightenment event ever happens. Focusing your process on getting a special experience can significantly hinder your work. Creating a powerful ego to drive to a goal is the very ego that you will in the end need to discard to reach beyond the mind. You do not suddenly master playing the piano, speaking a foreign language, rock climbing, painting abstract art, or doing mathematical equations. You get better and more effortlessly capable as you continue your practice, and your concentration, capacity, and understanding develop, whether or not you become a Picasso, Einstein, or even flawlessly fluent in French. So it is with meditative inquiry. And we'll end with this observation and really kind of warning. In your process of self-inquiry and discovery, the mind will use every trick and resource at its disposal to attempt to derail the process. Whatever your most deeply held fears, attachments, memories, anxieties, fantasies, and hurts are, they will eventually be brought into consciousness. This is not a game for the faint of heart. You are playing for all the marbles, and the I has its very existence at stake. As these great challenges emerge, welcome them, inquire into them, asking, who has this thought or feeling? Or where did this come from? What is this? What is Mu? The great challenges may emerge again and again, but ultimately they will lose their strength and ability to entangle you. Don't lose sight of the fact that enlightenment is about is about revealing that your real nature, your natural state, is stillness, happiness, and presence. It is not something you need to go out and manufacture or obtain. It is already there, here. All you need to do is get the clouds out of the way. I think we've used most of our time, but since it's not a Taisho, this is a Dharma talk, I'd like to open up the we can take just maybe a couple minutes for questions that someone might have about this.
Do even the authors talk about the effectiveness of really tuning into one's perceptions as a way to activate that neural network, or questioning as a way to kind of tie up all of our conceptual facilities? You talk about, do they discriminate between those two practices at all?
You know, as long as you're using the task positive network, you're doing something of value. I don't quite understand. I haven't. Your words are not very familiar to me. Could you repeat the two things again?
Yeah. So it seems like there are multiple ways to activate the task positive network.
Yes.
One is, and I guess both use absorption. One is absorption in our perceptions. And then another is to be absorbed in a kind of questioning, you know, to really tie up our mental facilities. And so I was wondering if either of those authors talk about if either of those practices do a better job of activating that task positive network, or more fully activating the task positive network.
Yeah, I would think that Gary Weber would answer it, that inquiry is the way. That, of course, with Shikantaza, which is like kind of what you're describing there, if you're paying attention, you are activating that. But the problem with that is that you need to break through the conceptualization of the human mind. And I'm not sure that Shikantaza has the same power to do that as inquiry. That's I'm not deadly sure of this, but that's my guess.
Yeah.
About it. Yeah. Anything? Okay, we'll stop here and recite the four vows.